Right, good afternoon, everybody. We're going to get started with this session. My name is Clive Aaron. I'm going to be chairing the session. And the topic of the session is using market-implied risk aversion to value all risk. And the presenter is Robert Bailey. Now, for those of you who have been following the development of market-consistent valuation techniques, I think you'll recognize that the question of how to allow for non-financial risk in a market-consistent valuation is really a key issue. And at the present time, we're seeing a lot of momentum building behind the use of market-consistent valuation techniques. The CFO Forum in Europe looks as if it's about to mandate the use of market-consistent valuations for published embedded values. Market-consistent valuation techniques are essentially underpinning what is on the table at the present time for Solvency II. And I wouldn't be surprised if down the track we see the IASB require similar valuation techniques for measuring insurance contract liabilities for accounting purposes. So if anything, I think having a sound basis for valuing non-financial risks is going to become a very important issue. In this context, I think that Robert has done a terrific job, really, in researching this topic and in putting down his thoughts in the paper that he's prepared. Now, the way we're going to run this session, I think, Robert, you're assuming you're not going to be taking the paper as read. So Robert will spend probably the first half of the session running through and giving us an overview of the paper, and then we'll open it up for questions and discussion. Before I hand over to Robert, let me just tell you a little bit about Robert. He has worked with AXA Asia Pacific since 1996 in a variety of actuarial roles, including product pricing, financial analysis projects, and M&A work. His current role is pricing and actuarial manager for AXA Australia's wealth management products. And as part of this role, he has implemented with other AXA colleagues a market-consistent value measure that also includes an allowance for non-financial risk. He has worked on other value and risk management issues with AXA colleagues from around the world to help develop common approaches to use throughout the AXA group. And, of course, Robert is a fellow of the Institute of Actuaries of Australia. So let me hand over to Robert.
Thank you, Clive. This paper arose from a desire to include an allowance for non-financial risk as part of an MCV value. Because the problem is, if you just follow the MCV rules, it treats non-financial risk, anything that's not related to the market, as risk-free. I certainly feel if we went to our CEO and said income protection business is now risk-free, I'd be fairly sure what his answer would be, and it wouldn't be that, yes, it is risk-free. So with some colleagues, we came up with an approach last year. It gave an answer, but there was always a nagging thought at the back of our minds. This was all very nice, but what does it mean? So then we hit the internet for inspiration, and was quite surprised with some of the things that we found there. And things which I thought that actuaries should know, things that link together risk and value, which seem to be very much outside the actuarial world. That's where the experts seem to be. So the end result was the paper that I put together. What I'm going through now is just going to touch some of the basics. If you are interested in it, then have a read the paper. And I think if you are seriously interested in it, then probably go straight to the references at the end, because that's probably where they can explain it much better than what I did. But I suppose one of the key things is not a lot of what I came up with was new. It has been applied quite a lot in the academic world, certainly in valuing financial risks, also in a general insurance risk. But I thought it was something that we didn't really use that much in financial services, but I thought it was something that we should know. So first, I better start off with a formula. So what I wanted to do was just start off with a... I just wanted a general approach for valuing any risk, It didn't have to be a normal risk. It could be anything. Could be it didn't have to be symmetrical, and it didn't have to vary with the market. So the formula that we came up with, well, the formula that we use is that basically value is the expected value of some factor M times the payout. And I couldn't resist putting in a Greek symbol there as well. So you can think of it just simply, it's the basically P is the probability, Z is whatever payout you're going to get with that probability, then M is some factor. Now, M is a set of stochastic discount factors. One of the things I found out when going through all this is that lots of people have lots of different names for M. But I was actually quite happy that I went to a presentation here yesterday by some two people from the PricewaterhouseCoopers, and even though there's lots of different ways that you can talk about this, both me and them came up with using the same formula and the same names. And part of that is good luck, but also part of it just goes to show that these formulas have been around for quite a long time. There's nothing new, so I don't think it was all that much luck that we both came up quite independently with the same approach. We're just talking about something that's been existing for quite a long time. So, but my focus was I wanted to come up with these factors M, these stochastic discount factors, that actually meant something. And it could be benchmarked against something. So we thought, you know, this gave us if we did this, we got a risk-adjusted value, but we wanted to have something sensible. So we wanted to have some criteria. So there was the usual suspects of different criteria. The larger the risk, then the larger the reduction in value. And we wanted to handle symmetrical risk and non-symmetrical risk. But there were two criteria which actually sort of guided the way for where we ended up being and guided the way for helping us to explain what we'd ended up with. So these two criteria were... we wanted something that was useful for enterprise risk management. So if we were using ERM, we wanted to have a value measure that was at least consistent with the work that we're doing there. But probably more importantly is the second point, which looks at financial risks. The value of any financial risk needs to be consistent with the observable market value for similar risks. So in lay terms, if we use this approach for financial risk, we needed to come back with the market value. There's no point coming up with a wonderful approach that doesn't give you the market value, because that's not going to be a market consistent value. What I might do is I want to explain financial risks in a little bit more detail, just to, because there's a couple of reasons for that. We wanted to understand what the approach was for market risks, and also there was a number of things in market risk that I've been calculating the MCV values for quite a while, but there were things that I didn't realise that I was actually doing and what it actually meant. Now, I'll be honest, the next two slides probably aren't vital in the whole presentation, and I think that combined with this being the last session on the last day, which, straight after lunch, in a dark room. If you do want to have a snooze, the next two slides are probably the best ones to do that. So this one, I hope this one's not that hard. Market consistent values for financial risks. Now I've made a few changes here. Z is our profit, but I've mapped it one-to-one to the level of the market, where X is the market. So because it's a financial risk, our profit Z depends with the market. It doesn't need to move in line with the market, it doesn't need to be a linear relationship, but there is just some one-to-one relationship. The theory for market-consistent values is the value is then the value of the replicating portfolio, something that provides the same cash flows at the same time. Now, The usual way, the usual textbook way of doing this is to use a binomial tree. I must admit, I've never seen binomial trees out in the real world. They only ever exist in textbooks. The way that we normally do it is the formula at the bottom. And I must admit, in the real world, or in my work world, I've never done any calculus either. But the simplest way of explaining an MCV value is, unfortunately, using a little bit of calculus. That's why I gave you the warning about falling asleep. You basically want to weight. You get your cash flows. You want to weight them with some factor, which I've called Q, and then discount them at the risk-free rate. So MCV is a risk-neutral approach, comes up with a risk-neutral assumption for Q. Now, Q is actually the standard name across the literature for this. I think it shows that it wasn't a life insurance actuary who came up with this, because, you know, P's and Q's have already been taken. So that's what you get. If you don't do it, someone else is going to take one of your symbols. And you actually do see this. Michael Sherris wrote something earlier this year, and he talked about Q probabilities. And I actually spoke to someone, you know, I took the paper, and I said, oh, do you know what Q means? Oh, no. But that's what you get. So let's look at Q in a little bit more detail. Q. Now, this one, Q is a risk-neutral distribution. Now, this is about as hard as it gets. VQDX, so unfortunately it's more calculus, is the value of an asset that pays 1 when the market is between X and DX, so DX being a small number. So if the market's at X, VQDX pays 1 and 0 at all other times. The usual formula, for the usual definition for risk-neutral formulas was uses deflators, and it says a deflator is something that the value of something that pays 1 in one scenario and 0 at all other times. So when I saw a projection of some deflators, and I got all excited before I was going to see it. I expected to see all these 1s and 0s there, but they weren't there, and I thought, what's it mean? So I didn't really understand the deflator one, but I thought this one explained it a bit better. That it's something that pays 1. For example, if the market hits 6,000 points, it pays 1. It pays nothing at any other time. Now, you can construct this using options, because options pay out at different points in the market. Using some pretty simple maths, you can actually buy and sell options at a close strike price that will pay you 1 when the market hits 1 point, and 0 at any other time. And my last point there was actually, I must admit, it's got nothing to do with what I'm talking about, but I just couldn't resist putting it in the paper, because I hadn't seen it before, and I thought it was such a fundamental thing that I didn't know, and I thought it was so easy that we should know. VQ, so our, basically, V is our risk-free discount rate. VQ is the second derivative of an option price with respect to the strike price. Now, I'm not going to go into that now. Just if you want to find out why, then I actually put it in as an appendix to the paper. I was tempted to put it in the main bit, but I thought it's got nothing to do with really what I'm talking about. I couldn't resist not putting it in because I thought this is something that we should know. And I actually asked a few people. I asked people who use risk-neutral distributions all day, every day, and asked them whether they knew this, and they didn't know it. I said, how do you get from an option price to a risk-neutral distribution at the end? They knew that you did. And then I said, oh, you just do. I asked some, you know, very experienced actuaries, how do you get it? She said, oh, I don't know. I'll have to ask some a rocket scientist. And it's actually not rocket science. But so if you're interested in that, and there are, especially in the references, it talks a lot about how to get a risk-neutral distribution from option prices, and it is actually quite simple. But hopefully that's given you enough time for a snooze. We'll get back onto something which has hopefully got no more calculus. This, I hope, is a bit more straightforward. We just want to know, my burning question was, could we get a risk-neutral distribution for something that wasn't traded? We can see that we, by getting option prices, if something has an option price, we can get a risk-neutral distribution by getting a nice move curve and taking the second derivative off it. But if we don't have options market, can we get a risk-neutral distribution? So here I've shown the risk-neutral distribution compared to a real-world distribution. So here, see, I've used a P and Q. I've stepped out of my life insurance world. The difference between the two is the equity premium. The mean of the risk-neutral distribution is 1 plus the risk-free rate. The mean of the real-world distribution is what the expected return should be. I've used the symbols Q and P. There's some great names for these two curves in the literature as well. And again, I can't resist sharing them with you. They actually describe, I think they're heavily influenced by the background of the person who wrote the paper. So Q is also known as an objective probability. It's objective because any two people should come up with the same value, because you can get it from traded option prices. Other names, it's also referred to as a distorted probability. And that's, I think, more of a general insurance one. They start off with P and then distort it to get to Q. Also known as a pricing kernel, but I think that's only academics who would say that, no one in the real world. Also known as a state price density and also known as a Q probability. P, a real world, also known as a realistic distribution. I thought, yeah, that's fair enough. Also known as a subjective distribution. I was a bit offended by that when I first read that, because I thought, you know, does that mean that actuaries are just making it up? But then you sort of, you know, yeah, there is judgment in coming up with P. You can't actually observe a real-world distribution. Certainly can't observe it before the event. It's also known as an implied distribution, beliefs, and also known, so the standard one is a P probability. So you read things like, people will write things like actuaries work in the P world and financial engineers work in the Q world. I think what we do is we actually do both. Particularly with ERM work, in the thing with, or the new work on investment guarantees, we actually use both P and Q. We use the P for, you know, where's the market going to end up? That's the real-world distribution. Within each point, we use a risk-neutral probability to find out what is the value of an option at each point. So it goes under various terms of stochastic, within stochastic and nested distributions. But there's actually a link between the two, and I think it's a link that we don't use, and a link that I think we think may not be, well, it's a link that we don't use, but there is actually a link there. So go to the next page, and the link is a stochastic discount factor. So I've got two ways of valuing the same thing. Under a risk-neutral world, we weight things by the risk-neutral probability. If we use real-world probabilities, we need to use some other factor to get back to the same value. And here I've called it MX, because everything depends, X is the level of the market, I've assumed, at all points. So I've said, well, in this case, because we're still talking about financial risks, M must depend upon the level of the market. Now, one solution for this, there's probably other solutions, but one simple solution is just to say, well, VX, which is the risk-neutral approach, must equal MP. If they're equal at each individual point, then they must come back with the same value. So that makes it quite easy to solve what M, the stochastic discount factor, must just therefore be the ratio of the risk-neutral probability divided by the real-world one, then multiplied by V to get a present value. So the ratio of the two probabilities actually has some meaning. It's the stochastic discount factor. This is all very nice, but it actually doesn't help us anywhere. Because if I know the real-world probability, then I need to work out the risk-neutral probability, work out the factor, then multiply it back again, and all it does is make the P's drop out of the whole thing. Because all it's saying is that the stochastic discount factor says, start off with a real-world probability, remove the real-world probability, and put in the risk-neutral one. So you may as well just go the risk-neutral one to start with. So that's why, for financial risks, we haven't really gone along this approach of getting stochastic discount factors, because we may as well just go straight to the risk, a neutral one. But it actually does help. Knowing M gives you some useful information. So let's look at the shape of M. So this is, if we were to divide those two distributions, what would we get? Now, I've assumed that the current level of the market is 1. So the x-axis is the future level of the market. So if it's saying that if the market falls, then in those particular cases, we should give those a higher weight. If the market rises, we'll give that a lower weight. It's kind of like a pessimistic approach. It's saying give more weight to the worst outcomes, less weight to the good outcomes. Given it's a dark room after lunch on the last day, I'm sure you can't, in your head, calculate what the average of that curve is. But the average is actually the risk-free discount rate. Because if you've got something that pays the same at every level of the market, then that must be risk-free. So therefore, you can just take, if it's paying 1 at each time, then you know that the average of that must be the risk-free rate. So again, this is sort of something, it's a bit useful. It's saying that give more weight to the worse outcomes, being less weight to the better outcomes. This is all very nice, but what does it mean? Now, there's a key relationship with utility theory. Now, if I thought binomial trees didn't exist in the real world, I certainly thought that utility theory would never exist in the real world. The only known natural habitat is in a textbook. So I was actually surprised that there was a real application. And so the key link with utility theory, and this is what sort of made me think about that we could apply this, for financial risks, stochastic discount factors are proportional to the marginal utility of the optimal market portfolio. It's a bit of a mouthful, and I won't prove it. There's enough papers that do prove it. But basically it's saying if you look at your stochastic discount factor, they are proportional to the marginal utility of the market. Again, this is all very nice, but it doesn't actually tell us some things. It doesn't tell us what the... It only tells us that it is proportional to something. It doesn't tell us what the marginal utility is. It doesn't tell us what the utility is. Now, in order to make sense with it, we actually need to go back to the 1960s for some people who actually looked at marginal utility and came up with their theory with formulas for risk aversion. This is Arrow and Pratt came up, and these are known as the Arrow-Pratt measures of risk aversion. Basically, they look at the shape of the marginal utility. In these cases, if you look at, so U is the utility function, W is wealth. So they, these very clever people, said that they came up with absolute risk aversion is the second derivative of the utility curve divided by the first. But we don't really need to worry about that, because we can go straight to our stochastic discount factors, which we know are proportional to marginal utility, and any of the proportion factors just drop out. So we can actually measure the risk aversion of the market by looking at the shape of the stochastic discount factors that we've calculated. We don't actually use the stochastic discount factors in financial risks, but we can look at what is the risk aversion applied within, that is implied by the shape of that curve. Now, of the two, relative risk aversion is probably the more useful one. I won't go into risk aversion. Again, if you are interested in it and it's something you want to find out more about, I think just go on the internet and type it in. There is lots of good sites that can give you some information. The important thing is, though, it's a way of describing the stochastic discount factor. You don't actually have to go to someone and say, oh, it's between 1.4 and 0.7. You can say it's got this risk aversion. So going back to the title of the paper was using the market implied risk aversion to value all risk. At this point, we've now worked out what the implied market risk aversion is. So let's go back at the graph and see whether that actually gives us more meaning of what the stochastic discount factor is. So this is the same one that we had before. Before, we can only look at it and say, yeah, it was high when the markets are low and low when the markets are high. We can now look at it a bit more closely. The pain from losing a dollar is greater than the joy of gaining $1. So if markets are down, I'm going to give that more weight than when markets are up. The curve of the line tells us the risk aversion, the curvature, or the risk aversion is the curvature of that line. Now, if you were to ask what is the curvature of that line, if you can do those calculations in your head, I wouldn't recommend it. In this particular curve, the relative risk aversion for this particular curve turns out to be a constant number over all points. Because I've just taken a really simple example here. I've assumed a log normal distribution for both the risk, the real world and the risk neutral one. I've assumed they're both log normal, and I've just divided one by the other. If you do your maths, well, that's what works out. If you look at the curvature of that line, it works out to be a constant. The relative risk aversion is a constant number. So something else that I didn't know, the Black-Scholes model is actually based on that. So all these years I've been using Black-Scholes and I didn't know that it implied a constant relative risk aversion. So it's something else that I knew. It doesn't help anywhere. But if anyone asks, you can say, oh, Black-Scholes, that uses a constant relative risk aversion. You might win a few bets. Or lose a few friends. It's it's up to you. Some other things to note. The line is actually convex. Because if it's got if you have a positive risk aversion, that gives you a convex line. So it slopes down, but the slope is, I must admit, I can never remember the difference between concave and convex. That is, take it from me, is a convex curve. But we'll come back to that later. As with the risk neutral and the real world probabilities, there's lots of names for this. So I've used stochastic discount factors. You can, the other names in the literature, risk transformations, that's more of a general insurance term, a risk distortion, a pricing kernel. If you're paying attention, that was also a name used for a risk neutral approach, so the academics can't even agree what they're going to call it. It's also known as a deflator, and that's for market consistent values. The word deflator is often the most common word used, and I didn't want to use it for this paper because I thought, to me, a deflator is not a romantic sounding name. It just sounds like a mechanical way to get from A to B. You may ask, why did I choose the slightly more romantic name of stochastic discount factor? But I thought at least that had a bit of meaning. We know what discount factors are and we know that they vary with risk. All we're doing is that one step further of having something not a constant discount factor, but having one that varies. Other names, stake price deflators, marginal utility, and I must admit my personal favourite, marginal intertemporal rate of substitution. That's another way to lose friends and influence people, is if someone gives, oh, look at the deflators, if they give you a stochastic output and there's deflators there, you can say, oh, I don't like your marginal intertemporal rate of substitution. So we can see that there is a relationship between a real-world probability and a risk-neutral probability. And this relationship has meaning. It is driven by the risk aversion. Non-financial risks, we can model the real-world probability. We can't observe directly the risk-neutral one. But now we can apply the risk aversion to try and derive a risk-neutral one. We can use these stochastic discount factors that have the same risk aversion as the market. Now, so the whole title of the paper, using the market-implied risk aversion, which leads to this curve, to value all risk. Now, we can't actually use this curve by itself to use. If we applied this curve, we would still end up with exactly the same problem, because the x-axis on this curve is the level of the market. If we mapped everything, a non-financial risk is independent of the level of the market. If we applied this curve to something which is independent of it, then we don't get that arm of relationship of having a high factor when you've got bad outcomes and a low factor at good outcomes. I think we need two ways to get that link. Firstly, we need an argument for why there is a link. And that's sort of one of the things that I do want to discuss with this paper, and I want to get your views on, is there a cost for non-financial risk? Now, I've come up with... The paper comes up with a couple of arguments, and I've come up with I've summarised a few of them here. So what does it take to apply the market-implied risk aversion to all risk? Now, the first one is like an internal view. And it's basically risk is risk is risk. This is, you know, I work for a financial services company. My view is very much internal to that company, that risk is risk is risk. If I'm valuing financial risk in one way, I should value any other risk in the same way, because I'm going to get hit just as hard no matter where the risk comes from. To say that a non-financial risk is unimportant because the shareholders can diversify away doesn't make the pain any less when I get hit when a non-financial risk comes along. So from an internal view, risk is risk is risk. If I know a risk aversion for financial risk, then I think it makes sense to value all risks on that side. However, from an external view, there's a very compelling argument to say if a risk is diversifiable away, it's risk-free, shareholders don't care about it. However, this may not be true, and I think there's an argument why it's not true, and that's the second point with MCVs and market capitalisation. It's readily accepted that an MCV overstates a company's market capitalisation. With the old approach where we had embedded values and appraisal value, we tended to get fairly close. MCVs overstate a market, the market capitalisation of a company. The reasons for this overstatement, the difference is just attributed to an agency cost or a frictional cost. Now, there's the usual suspects of frictional costs, that there's tax, double counting of tax. I think in the Australian market with franking credits, that's not a big driver. It may be a big driver in other markets. But there's two schools of thought about what the remaining ones could be. One school of thought is that profit volatility in itself reduces value. That if you're operating a company within a volatile environment, even if it's not related to the market, it's harder to deliver value. The markets, if it's harder to achieve and do the plan and achieve your strategic goals within a volatile environment. It's a bit like the first argument, though, that it's a bit of a internal view. The second view is that volatility increases costs from the best estimate. If profits drop, costs increase because you've got restructuring costs. If profits increase, costs increase as well because you've got softer cost controls. When profits are good, a company begins to not control its expenses. There's the mythical corporate jet and the gold-plated toilets. There's a paper on this, on frictional costs, by Nung and Varnell from the UK, and their first example of why costs go up when profits go up, and I couldn't resist saying this one, they said the first example is extra management and staff jollies. There's two points that came with me with this one. One was that there is a concept of a management and staff jolly. Perhaps some of my colleagues at work would suggest that we're on one now. The other one, though, the other was the extra. So not only in good times there is a concept of a management and staff jolly, but even in bad times there must be one. But that made all the research quite worthwhile coming across that sentence. However, they did come up with something. They said you should have a frictional cost function that should be a convex function of your profit. Now, if you remember back a few slides ago, the stochastic discount factor is a convex function. And they actually, one of their other colleagues actually did some clever maths that was beyond me. And they actually said, if you optimise this frictional cost function, it's the same as using a risk-adjusted probability using the market risk aversion. So that sort of came back to me. It didn't matter what school of thought you belonged to. If you thought profit volatility in itself reduced value, then you use a risk aversion. If you believe a frictional cost, then it works out that it's optimised using a risk aversion. So it probably doesn't matter what school of thought there is. I just thought it was probably that a good way of at least quantifying one part of the frictional costs was applying a risk aversion to the total profit volatility of the company, not just the market-related one. My final point is on enterprise risk management. And so I pulled out the definition. I hope this is still the ERM definition. You've probably seen it before. It's been around for a few years. ERM is the process by which organisations, blah, 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 monitor risks from all sources for the purpose of increasing the organisation's short and long-term value to all stakeholders. If you listen to what it doesn't say risks from financial sources to shareholders. MCV is financial risks to shareholders. ERM says all risks. So I thought this was an argument to say, well, why are you including non-financial risk? We're including it because it's consistent with ERM. Now, that was the argument for why, and I'm keen to get your views on why, or if at all, we can allow for non-financial risk in say, company valuations. The next is the how. How can we relate the stochastic discount factor that depends on the market, how can we relate that to the profit of a company? Now, we've got three changes here from the previous graph. One is the title has changed. And now, well, that's an important one. It's now a company-level stochastic discount factor. It's not for a financial risk, it's for a company profit. Second change, the x-axis has changed. It's now talking about a percentile. It's not talking about the level of the market. It's talking about a percentile. So now you can apply these factors to a percentile of the profit. At the top profit percentiles, you forecast out what your profit will be. At the top percentiles, you apply a low factor. At the bottom percentiles, you apply a low factor. You do that. The value that you get, the cost of risk is consistent with the cost of risk in your financial assets. This is all very nice, but what does it mean? I think there are some applications for this. I think you can come up with risk-adjusted values. Now, as mentioned, there was a session yesterday from PricewaterhouseCoopers where they have come up with a spreadsheet that comes up with the risk-adjusted values. Another big application for it, I think, is actually understanding the methods that we use at the moment. Under simple assumptions, this approach returns the cost of capital approach. And then it's worth knowing, well, what assumptions give that? The assumptions are that the risk is a normal risk in that it is, normally distributed. An important assumption and part of that is that it is a symmetrical risk. So if you've got a symmetrical risk and then apply constant relative risk aversion, you can get a cost of capital approach. If either of those things don't hold, like you've got a heavily skewed risk, like an operational risk, then cost of capital doesn't work for an operational risk. To say, I'm going to pick the 99.5% level and apply a factor to that, it doesn't... That is not... That is not that is not consistent with the other the other assumptions. It can also recover black Scholes. As I mentioned before, black Scholes is just this approach assuming a constant relative risk aversion. More importantly, I think it can be used for company valuations. You can look, and this, I think this is consistent with also the work done in Solvency II and the work coming out of the CFO forum in Europe. They're saying apply a cost of non-financial risk, and they assume the cost of capital approach. So we can say, okay, well, that assumes that's a normal risk and we've got a constant relative risk aversion, which in often financial risks don't assume, when a lot of the studies show that in market prices, the risk aversion is not necessarily constant. It actually, they give it the rather cute term that it smiles. It's the risk aversion goes up at very high levels and goes up at very low levels. But I can see that, I mean, it may be a long time into the future, but I think you can have an approach which is consistent with what Solvency II is saying, you know, and what ERM is saying, project forward, use an internal model, get a distribution of your future profit, your market risk. You should, you know, make sure that if you value that, you get back to the market price. If you use then the same cost of risk, then you can work out what is the market price for all other risks. So I think it's quite handy for ERM and getting diversification benefits. The last two are sort of looking at things in a slightly different way. This approach with stochastic discount factors looks at future outcomes and then applies a different factor to each one to get a risk-adjusted present value. You can also do it looking backwards. You can get observed outcomes. Say if you've got... it's often used for investment markets. You might get 24 monthly returns for the last 2 years. You get the manager return. You get the market return. When markets are up, you use a low factor. When markets are down, you use a high factor. And you can get a risk-adjusted historical return. And I think it's something that we don't use at all. I think the advantages of that, it doesn't use standard deviation or anything. You don't have to assume that you've got you're sampling from a normal distribution. The last one, equivalent risk portfolios. It's kind of, I don't know whether this is a genuine application or not. It might just be a more of a mathematical nicety. For any risk, you can work out a market risk that has exactly the same payout. The profile. It pays the same outcomes with the same probability, and the value for your risk is just the value of that portfolio. You can work out, you know, the what is the risk-free part of that. You know, it's sort of in the same way with a option. You can work out the delta and so on. You can do the same things for these. The key difference is that it doesn't pay. It pays the same outcomes, but not necessarily at the same time. But it may be a way to explain, well, what is the amount of risk in here? It might be a way just to sort of benchmark things. Now, there are some limitations with this. I'm not going to pretend this solves all the problems in the world. So there are some limitations. I want to quickly go through some of them. Agency costs. There's no guarantee that if you apply this to an MCV approach that you will explain all the agency costs. I'll be very surprised if it did. In fact, I wouldn't trust it if it did. The method is not arbitrage-free. It is for financial risks, but for non-financial risks, it's not arbitrage-free. You can't go off to the market and hedge it for that price. It's not trivial to derive the market's real-world view, the P. You know, any two people will come up with a different value for that. There's nothing to say that the market risk aversion should be your company's own risk aversion. Recovering the value of financial assets, I think it's best to use a risk-neutral approach and not a stochastic discount approach for financial risks, because there's a big risk that if you then, you know, once it starts getting complex with lots of different financial markets, you may find out you're not recovering the price of the financial risk. extension to the multi-periods. I think it actually doesn't extend to multi-periods. It only works over one period. So if you want to do this over 10 years, your period's going to be 10 years long. And it's not good for extreme risks. I think, you know, in terms of the unknown unknowns and things are right at the edge, I don't think we can come up with a good stochastic discount factor for things that are right at the edge. That's mine. I feel like I've zoomed through it. This is the last slide, which I was hoping it was over to you. It was. This has all been very nice, but what does it mean? I think the questions I've got is, does it have any real life? Can it be applied? What does it take to apply it? I suppose the questions that I've got is there really a cost for non-financial risk? You know, for people like me working inside a company, I think, yep, definitely there is. But I think what I need is a strong argument for the people who just say, nope, there are Nobel Prizes given to people who say there is no, that non-financial risk is risk-free. And I can't really compete with the Nobel Prize, so I'll have to agree with them. But it just doesn't seem right. And I think what we need is that strong argument. And the other question I've got is, does it make sense to apply the market's risk aversion to all risks, or should financial risks and non-financial risks have a different level of risk aversion? So I'll be quite interested to hear what your views. I'm sorry, I've gone a bit over time. We've got about 15 minutes left.
Thanks very much.
It does work for multi. The way to work it for multi periods, that I think, you need to get a risk aversion that applies over a long period of time. If you're using a market one, because my approach is that you should use the market aversion the risk aversion that's implied in the market. If you do it for a 1 year period, then for a 2 year period, there's a correlation within there that may not be the same correlation that you've got between two of your risks. If I've got a mortality risk, between each year they're probably not correlated. But for a market risk, the 2 years are correlated. So I think the way you need to do it is work out what the profit is at the end of the period. So you need to accumulate your 2 years and come up with, well, what's the accumulated profit at the end of 2 years? So I think it can be done. It's just I don't think you can look at each year independently. Maybe you can. I'm certainly not standing up here to say that I've solved all this. Part of the reason I've done this is actually to have, it may seem strange, I want sort of people to find holes in it and say why it can't work. But I think the way to do it over multi-periods is you have to accumulate the years gather and find a accumulated profit, at say, at the end of 2 years or in the 5 years. And I've got one view about Europe, but I probably shouldn't share that. Now, what do you do when the world's about to blow up? You move to Europe because everything happens there 20 years later. I don't know. I mean, there's the things that I thought that should be part of the, you know, really basic actuarial studies, and I was surprised why it wasn't there. And I think it is so close that, and I think it's the practical implications of it. What's something that, you know, we need something that everyone can do, even if they don't have a stochastic model. So we can see under simplified assumptions, then it does make sense. You can just use cost of a capital approach. And so I think their approach is, well, let's make sure everyone can do it using a cost of capital approach. I mean, I would certainly love to see that in another couple of years, or however long it takes, that they then do move and say, well, you should use a stochastic approach if you've got an internal model and you've got a full range of profit outcomes from all sources. I mean, eventually all the academic stuff does end up, or most of it does end up, in the real world. And I think it does. I think it is starting, certainly the PwC is now pushing their model that does the same thing. So I think it is slowly all coming together. There's the big question then, and this, there's three things that all hold to together. That if you, there's three things, if you know two of them, you can work out the third. That's the risk neutral distribution, the real world distribution, and the risk aversion. We know in the last 6 months, 6-12 months, that the risk neutral distribution has changed. So the question is, has that changed because the real world probabilities have changed, or has risk aversion changed as well? And I think over the last, I looked at it, but I suspected it's a combination of both. Things happened in the US subprime market that impacted us here, and that would be because the risk aversion changed. You know, there was nothing to say that our market had changed. Just all of a sudden, people were more averse to risk, so therefore that dropped dropped the price. But I think there then has been a follow-on impact as well, that our markets, certainly our volatility, has gone up. Now whether that's people just only reassessing risk, or because there has been some structural change. The interesting thing is, of those relationship, two, you can work out the third. Different people have different views about which is the more stable one. That central banks look at the risk-neutral distribution that they can get from option prices, and then overlay that with a constant, with a stable risk aversion, and that tells them. With that, they think, well, then I can work out what the market thinks that the future the returns will be. But I don't think that will pick up what's happened over the last 6 months. I think the risk aversion has changed. There was a study that one way of looking at the risk aversion, that some people looked at the Russian crisis in 1998, and they could look at the shape of the implied stochastic discount factoring and see that it sort of peaked at 1998 following the Russian crisis. So people do look at it to tell them what the risk aversion of the market is. But I think we're probably too soon, because we don't know how the real world distribution has changed at the moment. But having said that, it's not taken for granted that, I think there's one limitation by using the market implied risk aversion is that, if the market changes, that means the cost of our risk, of our mortality risk, or our operational risk has all of a sudden changed. Is that necessarily a good thing or not? But I can see these things sort of probably being updated once a year rather than sort of more regularly. I think I'll answer the second one first. That's the whole problem that I've got, in that we need the strong argument. It's not arbitrage free, and you can do so. Does that make it useful, or because it's not arbitrage free, therefore it's not useful at all? The simple answer to make it arbitrage free is you just assume that it's risk free. So you just something. You just take that your it's just equal to the mean, that there's no risk margin at all, but that doesn't seem to make sense, because you do have to hold a capital for things. So whilst it's not arbitrage free, and that certainly is a limitation, at least tells you. I think it shows that you can change your value by changing your risk. You can work out the value and then decide, well, do I hold it, or do I try and pass the risk off? Do I, is it worth, in order to get rid of this risk, it's going to cost me $1 million. If I use this approach, the reduction in value is only $500,000. It actually tells you, well, do I keep the risk or not? Now, for a financial risk, the cost of hedging or the cost of holding it should be exactly the same. There's no arbitrage. You can't get any value from hedging it or not. You can certainly get risk, but you can't get value. But I think for non-financial risk, I think whilst it's not arbitrage free, I think that there is an argument for that. I've got it as a limitation. I think it's actually it could also be a positive. It's the whole point of doing something. There's a couple of different ways. I can keep the risk or I can pass the risk off. If it's arbitrage free, they should both be the same. If it's not arbitrage free, they will be different. And so that's going to tell me for my risk management, do I keep the risk or do I insure the risk or do I change my, or do I avoid the risk? And we're in the business of accepting risk. And so I think for our risk that we're doing, there is not an efficient market. And we can add value by taking on those risks. And that's the reason why it's not arbitrage free. We can take on a risk and we can add value from doing it. So yeah, in theory, it is a shortfall, but in practice, I think it's where we actually do add value. One thing I've not done, you asked how in practice we can get the stochastic discount factors. That's kind of as close as what we've got so far at the moment. We've got our, that's based on about a 3% equity premium and a 15% volatility assumption. That was when I started doing this, was about 12 months ago. That would have made sense then. Volatility is now probably 20-25%, and risk premiums probably haven't changed. So the way that we got it out is that we had a projection system that gave us risk neutral projections and real world projections, and we just took a simplified approach and looked at the and assumed that they were log normal and just took out the volatility from the volatility was the same for both, so we just looked at the risk premium between the two of those. There certainly is a lot of literature about getting the market implied discount rates. I think two of the, so I think it's best to look at those ones. I think the key person is Jackworth. I think look at the, we're probably running out of time, but look at the references in the paper. There's Jackworth, recovering risk aversion from option prices and realised returns. I think that's sort of the leading paper. And another one by 8, Sahala and Lowe, non-parametric estimation of state price densities implicit in financial asset prices. And they're sort of the standard texts on this.